Hello, this is Chris Yerkes reading to you from the March 15th edition of the Journal. And the main page features a picture of the Tuscola Warrior boys basketball team holding up the third place trophy which they earned at the 2023 IHSA State Championship. The article about this is titled The Dream Season by Lenny Cementi. A historic dream season for Tuscola boys basketball team will end with the program's first ever state tourney hardware. And the 22-23 Warriors will hang a banner in the gym for the first time since the Elite Eight squad of 1989. Coach Justin Bozarth and his assistants Jacob Hilgendorf and Luke Johnson, Chase Reedy and Bob Taylor, and the boys in black and gold ended the year with a program best 31 wins, finishing with a 31-7 record overall, collecting a third place trophy at the IHSA state tournament. Included in the historic were titles at the Monticello, Holiday Hoopla, the Tuscola Regional, the Altamont Sectional, and the SIU Carbondale Super Sectional. All-state second-team selection Jordan Quinn and his buddies used a two-game slump early in February as motivation, producing an eight-game winning streak, earning a spot in the Final Four in a trip to the State Farm Center. A lopsided 64-38 win over Altamont at the Central Illinois Conference National Trail Conference shootout got the ball rolling. The Indians were ranked number one at the time, but couldn't keep pace with the sharp-shooting Warriors that connected on 65% of their forays outside the arc, tallying 17 threes in all. Altamont made another run at Bozarth's bunch in the sectional championship with a spot in the Elite Eight on the line, building its 16-point lead early in the second half. But a three barrage by Quinn and the Warriors, along with a smothering defensive effort by the Warriors, led by senior Colton Musgrave, erased the deficit and the Warriors moved on in a four-overtime 72-68 victory. Musgrave was a constant on the defense the entire year and hit the boards hard, grabbing 104 on the year. Tuscola lived on the arc during the season, boasting five players in all with over 30 threes on the season. Sophomore Cam Sweetenham led the way with 88 trays on the year, en route to his second-best 438 points. Quinn, a junior, was next up with 57, delivering a team-best 514 points. A pair of Quinn's classmates, Jackson Barrett and Josiah Horton, followed with 39 and 36 respectively. Parker James, another second-year player, ended his season with 34 makes from the arc, helping him climb above the 300 plateau, donating 302 points to the cause. Chris Boyd did his damage in the paint. The senior capped off his career with a double-double in the third-place win over Bloomington Cornerstone, grabbing 10 rebounds while adding 17 points to the team totals. He eclipsed 290 points on the season, and none were bigger than a three-ball in the comeback win against Altamont in the sectional title game. Boyd, who hauled in 170 rebounds over the past 4 months, was only behind Quinn, who brought in 284 boards. Also making the trip north to the state tournament were injured seniors Hunter Bracca, Boston Brody, and Grant Kaufman. Sophomores Andrew Spillman and Sawyer Woodard, along with freshman Logan Kurtz, got on the floor late in the final skirmish of the year. Woodard scored 110 points this season as a post alternative when Boyd was not on the floor for the Warriors. Bozarth finished his sixth season and now owns three 20-win seasons and now has a 30-win campaign, finishing with 31 this year. When asked about the season, Bozarth grinned and said, "This group never ceased to amaze me. No matter what kind of day I had, they always brought a smile to my face. I was never so proud as I was when Chris was asked at the pep rally before we left for state how he thought things were going to go, and he simply said, 'We just need to trust in the Lord. It's an unselfish group that just wanted to succeed. Our seniors will be missed.'" Quinn, an all-tournament selection at the Hoopla, grabbed second-team All-Illinois Coach Association accolades and the Chicago Sun-Times second-team honors, as well as unanimous selection to the CIC All-Conference team, and also collected the squad's MVP and rebound award. Horton and Sweetenham's prowess in the front court earned them both second-team All-CIC honors. Horton came home with the team's free-throw award from the end-of-the-year banquet. Another front page story, City Backs Mall Sale by Dominic Stallings. Arana 2 LLC has a contract for the purchase of the Outlet Mall in Tuscola. It is the same group the city has worked with in the past in their attempts to purchase and redevelop the property. The agent for the corporation is Al Ruggieri, an associate attorney working in real estate business and corporate transactions. The purchase contract provides a 120-day due diligence period, which has already begun approximately a week and a half ago. City Administrator Drew Howell said the due diligence gives the buyers the opportunity to find any pitfalls. The group requested the city's assistance in completing surveying, engineering, legal, and planning efforts through various consultants. Howell said they're talking to tenants and are looking to reinvigorate the property. The group hopes to identify future costs and redevelopment strategies for the property. According to the documents provided by the city, the group has already invested substantially in legal fees and earnest money to secure the contract. The council approved $86,000 in tax increment financing, TIF, funds to complete the due diligence activities before a potential purchase closure. The mall was bought by Long Island-based Mason Asset Management on December 15, 2021, for a reported $6.25 million from ADCO Group. Before then, it sold for $19 million in 2015 from Tanger. Hull said the mall is generating less sales tax revenue than before, but he does not have an exact figure on the decline of the sales tax due to the current owners not providing that data. Previous owners had a provision with the city that gave them information on sales tax figures. However, Hull noted that local tax revenue has gone up to pre-pandemic levels due in three parts: Love's Travel Center, the internet sales tax distribution, and inflation. In other news, the Tuscola City Council also discussed concept drawings for the downtown green space next to the community building during the March 13th meeting. In the agenda provided by City Administrator Drew Hull, the council reviewed three different concepts. The council agreed that concepts B and C, pictured below, were the preferred candidates. The concepts are not final and can be mixed and matched. Engineers will finalize the concept into construction drawings and bid specifications. The council finalized public committee meeting dates. Public Works will meet on March 27th at 3 p.m. Public Safety will meet on March 30th at 5 p.m. Community Development Planning will meet on March 28th at 4 p.m. Finance and Administration will meet on March 29th at 4 p.m. Hull said the city will publish notices of all the meeting dates as well. Hull wrote that Utz and Associates recommends that the city combines the proposed addition to this street shed with the new fire department building into one bid. The company is also making some revisions to the design with the footing and foundation systems that will hopefully lower the cost of the street shed addition. The bids are expected to be advertised within the next few weeks. The city was granted a demolition order from the court to start demolition on the Castle Mall property. Ezel Excavating was the low proposal for the demolition and plans to start demolition of the property within the week. City Attorney Andrew Baquette said the previous owner's attorney consented to the order of demolition. Baquette said he received the signed settlement agreement but is awaiting the deed and the transfer tax document. Baquette added that he does not doubt the previous owner's good faith. Lisa Wasilowski has hired to be the replacement for the records clerk position since Angie Gordon is retiring in June. Hull said there is no effective date for her yet, but expects Wasilowski to start work in 3 or 4 weeks. She'll be paid $20.50 per hour with a 50-cent increase in 6 months. Hull added that there might be a wage increase in the meantime, and the 50-cent increase would be added on top. Another front page story, DCFB donates books to local libraries. In recognition of March being National Agriculture Month, the Douglas County Farm Bureau recently donated 2 books to area and school libraries. The Pig War was written by Emma Band Smith and illustrated by Allison Jay. This picture book tells the story of the boundary dispute in the Pacific Northwest that was ignited because a wayward pig in a neighbor's potato field. Winged Wonders Solving the Monarch Migration Mystery, written by Meeg Pincus and illustrated by Yaz Imamura. This book explains the vast number of people involved in finding the migration route of monarch butterflies from Canada to Mexico. It highlights the fact that the citizen scientists can have an impact. And the last front page story, Joe Landeck Looking Back on an Influential Villa Grove Teacher, by Tony Hooker. For a generation of Villa Grovians, Joe Landeck was the cool fifth-grade teacher sporting the mod sideburns, playing records in class, and riding his Honda motorbike to work. Truthfully, I'm one of the lucky students who had him as a teacher, and to this small-town boy, he was about as cool as they come. For another generation, he's the PE teacher and DJ, bringing the party to life in the gym, sometimes a bit too loudly for the taste of certain administrators. Still another generation remembers him as a substitute teacher. For the better part of 50 years, he's been part of Villa Grove schools. Mr. Landeck, where did you grow up? Oak Forest, Illinois, a South Chicago suburb. Where did you graduate? Tinley Park High School. Did you always know that you were going to be an educator? I always wanted to be one because when I was in Catholic school, I had nuns most of the time, and I looked upon teaching as gods with a small g, and I could never be a god. My seventh grade teacher, Miss Kelly, probably inspired me the most to be a teacher. I actually wasn't even planning on going to college, but my next door neighbor asked me where I was going to go, and I just to play along, I said, I don't know. And then he told me I could go to Eastern because that's where he was going. I had no clue where Charleston, Illinois was. When I went to Eastern in the summer to register for classes, the guy asked me where I was going to major in, and I said I didn't know what he was talking about. He asked me what I like to do, and I told him I like sports. So he said, do you want to be a PE teacher and coach? And I said, okay. How did you come to teach in Villa Grove? When I graduated, I taught 2 years in Country Club Hills, where my wife Sandy went to school. She knew a boy whose dad was the superintendent there, and they got me a job there. It was a junior high, and they didn't have sports, and I wanted to get into coaching. And Villa Grove had a fifth grade teaching job along with assistant basketball and football coaching positions. So that's how I wound up here. Mr. Gaines, the superintendent then, had three rules that all teachers had to live by to teach in Villa Grove. Number one, we had to live in town. Number two, we had to go to church regularly. And number three, we couldn't be seen in public smoking, drinking, or using bad language or anything like that because he wanted us to be role models. Was it a big transition for you to come from the big city to the little town? Not really, because I'd lived in Charleston, which was a small town for 4 years when I grew up. Oak Forest was kind of out in the boonies. We were 10 miles south of Midway Airport, which was the only airport in Chicago at that time, so it didn't really get busy until you got all the way downtown. How did you move from teaching fifth grade to teaching PE? They dropped PE for financial reasons for a while, and then when they decided to get it back, Mr. Powell asked me if I wanted to be the PE teacher, and I said, sure. So I taught fifth grade for 11 years and then PE and driver's ed for 21 years. When did you start at Villa Grove? In 1970. Over the years, I've become aware of some of your interesting hobbies. You're one of the who instilled a love of trivia in me way back in 1975. You had baseball card collections and record collections. How did all of that come about? I've always liked music, but growing up in Catholic schools, we didn't have music or art or PE. So on my first day at Tinley Park, a brand new high school, I'm walking in around and I see a music room and I stopped and asked if anyone could take the class. And he said, sure, what instrument do you play? And I told him I didn't play anything, but I'd like to learn something. He told me he'd contact me, and I'm still waiting. He didn't want me in band because everyone else would have experience, and he had to teach me everything. I'm not really good at it, but I've taught myself to play guitar and piano. That's why I got into DJ work, because I love music. When it went back to computers, I kind of backed out of it because I have records. That's why I have such a huge record collection. I've sold most of my LPs now. When I was teaching at Eastern after I retired from here, I was telling my students how I used to bring 45s to school, and one girl thought I brought my guns to school. I've always collected baseball cards since I was 5 or 6 years old, and I finally sold that collection. Even now, 50 years later, I remember certain ways that you taught, like including music and trivia, which were unique in my K-12 experience. How did you learn to incorporate all of that? When I did my homework, I always had music on in the background, so I thought that I could do that for the kids out here and see if students seem to enjoy it. What are you up to these days? I play a lot of golf these days. In the summer, Howard Osborne and I play a lot. I still do some subbing during the school year, maybe not too much, but it beats sitting at home. Since COVID, we don't travel and see the grandkids as much as we did. It must have been an okay career because your kids followed you into the profession, right? My daughter is a special ed teacher who teaches in Pontiac. My son Lance went from teaching in Tuscola to principal in Atwood to superintendent in Oakland. My oldest granddaughter taught for a few years, but when they had children, she got out of it. When she went back to work, she found a job at a bank. Looking back, I still think I couldn't have had any better teachers in grade school than you, Mrs. Simpson, Mrs. Duncan, Miss Brewer, Mrs. Ping, and Mr. Keitzman. All of you were at the top of your game. It was a fantastic group that we had out here, and always supporting each other. Was your career everything you thought it would be? I don't know what else I would have done. I couldn't sit behind a desk all day. To this day, I still can't. Now we'll move on to the obituaries. Mary Lou Flanagan, 93, of Bement, passed away at 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, March 9, 2023, at the Arbor Rose in Monticello with her daughters by her side. Memorial services will be held at 1 p.m. on Thursday, March 23rd, at the Heinz Funeral Home, 348 North Pyatt Street, Bement. Visitation will be held from 12 noon until time of services at the funeral home. The pastor, Naomi Roberts, will officiate. Burial will be at the Bement Township Cemetery. Memorial contributions can be made to the Bement EMTs or to the American Red Cross. Robert D. Bobby Benson, 50, of Bement, passed away on Thursday, March 9, 2023, at 10:15 a.m. at his residence in Bement. Visitation was Tuesday, March 14 at the Heinz Funeral Home, Bement, followed by the funeral service. Pastor Lenny Summer officiated. Private burial will be in the Bement Township Cemetery. Memorial contributions can be made to the American Cancer Society. John Otto, 83, of Arthur, passed away at 8:20 p.m. on Tuesday, March 7, 2023, at his residence. Funeral services were held on Saturday, March 11th at the HCK West Building, Arthur. Bishop Harvey L. Chupp officiated. Burial was in the Otto Cemetery in rural Arthur. Visitation was Thursday, March 9th and Friday, March 10th at the HCK West Building. The Edwards Funeral Home assisted with arrangements. Maxine B. Chapman, 98, of Atwood, passed away at 4 p.m. Monday, March 6, 2023, at the Good Samaritan Hospital, Mount Vernon. Funeral services celebrating her life were held Saturday, March 11th at the Hilligoss Schrader Funeral Home, Atwood. Burial was at the Mackville Cemetery, Atwood. Visitation was held Saturday at the funeral home. Sharon L. Bullock, 83, of Mattoon, died at 11:30 p.m. Monday, March 6, 2023, at Odd Fellows Rebecca Home in Mattoon. Private family graveside services were held Monday, March 13th at the Arthur Cemetery, Arthur, with Pastor Jill Bunker officiating. Schrader Funeral Home, Arthur, assisted the family with the arrangements. There was no public visitation. Kenneth R. Bontrager, 63, of Sullivan, passed away Monday, March 6, 2023, at 10:26 p.m. at his home, surrounded by his family. Visitation was Thursday, March 9th and Friday, March 10th. The funeral service was held on Saturday, March 11th. All services were held at Solid Rock Chapel in Sullivan. Burial was at the Green Hill Cemetery. Edwards Funeral Home of Arcola assisted with the arrangements. Memorials can be made to Solid Rock Chapel. Robert Bob Eugene Lauder passed away on March 5th, 2023, with family at his side. There's no further information about memorials or funeral services. Dylan O'Yakel, 73, of Arthur, passed away at 1:49 p.m. on Saturday, March 11, 2023, at Sarah Bush Lincoln Health Center in Mattoon. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Tuesday, March 14th, at the Arthur United Methodist Church, 128 East Illinois Street in Arthur. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, March 15th, at the Arthur United Methodist Church. The Reverend Jill Bunker will officiate. A funeral luncheon will be served at the church prior to the burial. Burial will be at the Liberty Cemetery in rural Sullivan. The Edwards Funeral Home is assisting with arrangements. Edna Nisney, 90 years, 2 months, and 1 day old, of Springfield, Ohio, formerly of Arthur, passed away peacefully March 6, 2023 at 11:45 p.m. at Wooded Glen Health Campus in Springfield, Ohio. Funeral services were held on Saturday, March 11th at the Sunnyside Mennonite Church in Arcola with Pastor Larry Rock officiating. Burial was at the Sunnyside Mennonite Church Cemetery. Visitation was held prior to the funeral at the church. Edwards Funeral Home, Arcola, assisted with the arrangements. And now we have time for My Personal Side by Craig Hastings. It's almost 11 p.m. on Saturday night, and in an hour, I'll finish up age 65 and move on to the first day of 66. I haven't really liked to talk about my age much, but let's say the last 20 years, but I'm being reminded the alternative is not getting older, it's just that not getting older. I certainly don't want that. So what does a single guy living alone do on his 65th birthday anyway? In my case, what I did today is what I've done on most of my previous birthdays. Not too much. I've never been someone who felt the need to celebrate the day after yesterday just because it was the anniversary of the day I was born. Now, I know I'm probably the odd man out with my opinion on this day of each of our lives, but it's always been me. Of course, when I was little, I enjoyed my parents buying me gifts for my birthday, but selfishly, that was the only thing important to me about a birthday. The only birthday I looked forward to without presents was my 16th birthday, and that was because I could get my driver's license. After I outgrew getting gifts as a child from my parents, I never expected or really wanted any more birthday presents from anyone. However, that mindset changed a bit in the past year or so, ever so slightly. I've always told my boys to please not buy me anything for my birthday. I did so again this year, especially now that both of them are out on their own trying to make their own way in life. I'd much rather they spend their hard-earned money on themselves and not me. Like many of you, there is something little I need or I want. I just go out now and get it at this point in life. I'm certainly not going to wait weeks and months to ask for whatever it is I want for my birthday. Peyton did surprise me with something today that was unexpected and didn't cost a thing but a trip to Tuscola. Last fall, Peyton moved out of the house and down to Charleston. He'd gotten a Labrador months before he moved out, and me being the dog person I've always been most of my life, I grew very close to Brody. Well, today Peyton brought Brody to Tuscola to see me on my birthday, unannounced but extremely welcome gesture. Brody, even though he isn't here very often anymore, comes right into the house like he still owns it. He visits all of his favorite nooks and crannies to make sure no other dog or cat has invaded his space while he's been away. After his inspection is finished, he perches himself up in the bay window where he's always stationed himself just so to watch over everything going on in his castle. He's a wonderful dog. He loves everyone and wouldn't bite to save his own life, I think. Having German Shepherds for 30 years, this is a pleasant characteristic to have in a dog now. I'm sure a visit from a dog on my birthday when I was 8 years old instead of presents wouldn't have thrilled me so much. So I said earlier that my mindset of getting gifts on my birthday has changed a bit as I've gotten older. Birthday presents are usually material things that we give people because we think they may be able to use them in some capacity in their day-to-day lives. An exception, I guess, is jewelry or an equivalent people give to express their love for someone on their birthday. Can we meet someone who puts a new twist on giving on your birthday? Could it be it's no longer about the gift itself, but the unseen meaning held within the gift? Could the gift be a bridge by the person giving it to express their feelings when words alone won't do it? I believe this is true. Maybe I've gotten a bit wiser now that I've grown older. Maybe I'm shedding some layers of my cold, hard shell that I've always prided myself on to protect my emotions because I didn't want to appear soft to the people who know me. Can life really continue to get better when a person enters their third and final part of life? When I turned 60, I certainly thought it was the beginning of my end, and I was prepared to accept it. Today, as I finish my final hour of being 65, I'm cutting my life's pie in quarters instead of thirds and believing I have a long way to go, on my way to 67 and feeling much better about it. And there's another article, Gary Alexander and Coach Kincaid look back on the 1989 state competition by Dominic Stallings. Tuscola last went to the state basketball competition 33 years ago in 1989. Back then, there were a lot of differences. There were fewer classes. Small schools like Tuscola would compete against larger schools. Some things that haven't changed is the feeling of going to state, standing on the court of a large arena, even the way teams need to come together to succeed. Superintendent Gary Alexander was one of the players on the court 33 years ago. It was exciting just because we were playing at the U of I basketball court, said Alexander. Back then, the basketball team was really good. You knew the names on the lockers, and an 18-year-old kid, it was exciting. Alexander said he and his team were there for a reason. They were very focused on playing their best. My favorite part about being on the team was being with the guys I grew up with. We played for one another, kind of like this year-round team, said Alexander. What I saw from sitting in the stands was what they didn't care who scored, didn't care about newspaper recognition. They just wanted to get together and play and win games. The Warriors ended up winning third place in the 2022-2023 1A state championships. Alexander noted there were a few similarities from more than 30 years ago. In the 2021-2022 season, the Warriors lost in their super sectional. The Warriors also lost the super sectional in 1988, a year before going to state. It's just weird how things are similar, but I finally got my medal, said Alexander. As superintendent, he received a medal this year along with the coaches. Alexander's favorite memory from his season weren't at state. They were from the super sectional game. In 1989, the Warriors were down by 18 points in the fourth quarter, but they ended up bouncing back and won by 2 points. It was pretty exciting. We probably shouldn't have won, but we went out and we did it, said Alexander. The Warriors sectional game in Altamont will likely be an excellent memory for many of the players and parents who attended with the Warriors going into fourth overtime and eventually beating the Altamont Indians. Alexander learned a lot of different things from his time in athletics. It taught me commitment. Sport teaches you how to work with one another. Everything is not fair. You win, you lose. How you pick yourself up from losses is what makes you better. It teaches you so many different lessons. You will not always be the best, and that's okay, said Alexander. Not only our boys' team, but our girls' team had a wonderful year. I just found out the Science Olympiad made it to the state. Greece is going on right now. We have a ton of kids in that, said Alexander. I appreciate that and the community and the support they get from the schools. We have good kids. They will make mistakes, but that's why they're kids. We have great kids, and the community and the parents have a lot to do with that. As superintendent, he realized how much work went into sending the Warriors to state this year and found a lot of appreciation for Mike Damler and his staff for all the work that they did in his day. Damler was principal in 1989. Alexander himself spent all day on Tuesday, March 7th, preparing for the state tournament. They had the tenacity, they showed as a group, and they listened to Coach Bozarth. Coach and his staff did a wonderful job keeping them engaged. They stayed together, they didn't point fingers, they trusted one another and their coaches, said Alexander. Alexander found a lot of appreciation for his coach back in 1989, Coach Kerry Kincaid. I appreciated Coach Kincaid more than I ever did. Coach Kincaid was a great coach and he held high expectations for us. He did a great job of putting us in situations that allowed us to win, said Alexander. When Alexander was fighting cancer, Coach Kincaid sent him a card with an article from the News Gazette about Alexander. It wasn't about basketball, it was about relationships. At 18, you don't understand that, said Alexander. I loved playing for him. He wanted what was best for us. Kincaid was head coach for 11 years and coached basketball for 18 years and volleyball for 17. Unfortunately, Kincaid was unable to see both games and only saw the first game for a little bit. However, he understands the difficulties the students face when they play for the first time in such a large arena. The backdrop is so much more difficult. It takes a bit of getting used to for the kids, said Kincaid. He said he doesn't see a lot of the kids back from his coaching years, but when I see them, it's good to talk with them, said Kincaid. Kincaid said that he wasn't surprised when a lot of the kids he coached found success later in life. They had good work ethic in basketball. They were pretty successful. You know that would carry over in the real world, so to speak, said Kincaid. While he wants his kids to cherish the memories they made in sports, he also wants the kids to realize there are many more things to experience later in life. I said this many times when I had good teams. Don't let this be the highlight of your life. You have a lot of things to look forward to, but there are a lot of good things to look back on and cherish, said Kincaid. The DAR celebrates centennial. The centennial anniversary of the Stephen A. Douglas chapter, NSDAR, was celebrated on March 1st at the Iron Horse Golf Course in Tuscola with a luncheon for 50 DAR members. 28 chapter members, 2 DAR past chaplain generals, 2 past Illinois state regents, 6 Illinois state organization officers, District 3 Director Deborah Sandercrock, and 3 chaplain regents from District 3 were present to hear the Illinois DAR state regent Deborah Coe remind us that the DAR is not the same as it was when our grandmothers belonged. Her experience and personal observation show that DAR is now more diverse in membership, more volunteer-minded, more computer-savvy than ever. Representing the mayor of Tuscola, Dan Kleiss, city administrator, Drew Hole, brought the city's proclamation that March 1st was declared the Stephen A. Douglas chapter of the Daughters of the American Revolution Days. The chapter's display, vintage displays of 1920s antiques and memorabilia, was a hit with the guests and fun for the members to bring the 100-year-old items in to show other members. State Senator Chapin Rose brought an Illinois Senate proclamation recognizing the 100th anniversary of Stephen A. Douglas chapter, NSDAR. Pictured with the senator is Deborah Coe, Illinois DAR state regent, Martha Burris, chapter regent, Jane Faust, chapter vice regent, and Senator Rose, and chapter member Jackie Joins. Lakeland graduation. Lakeland College will celebrate with graduates during the commencement ceremony on Friday, May 12th at 6 p.m. in the Fieldhouse. The process to sign up for commencement can be completed online. There's no cost to order a cap and gown or to participate in the ceremony. The first step is to file an intent to graduate in the student portal, the Laker Hub. After filing the intent, admissions and records will send the graduate a letter with instructions how to measure for cap and gown online at the Laker Hub. The deadline to file for intent to graduate is Friday, March 17th. The deadline to measure for cap and gown is Friday, March 31st. For information, contact Admission and Records, Luther Student Center, 217-234-5434. And finally, check alarm batteries. Now that the time has changed, it's a good time to check the batteries in your smoke detectors and carbon monoxide detectors. According to the Fire Safety Alliance, a new law took effect in January requiring the alarms with a 10-year sealed batteries to be installed in all single or multifamily homes moving forward. For homes with removable batteries and existing alarms, the sealed batteries are required once the alarms have surpassed their manufacture date. Homes built after 1988 that have hardwired alarms are exempt from the new requirement. In recent years, the National Fire Prevention Association has reported that 3 of every 5 home fire deaths in the U.S. have resulted from non-working smoke detectors. In Illinois, of the 97 fire deaths that occurred in 2021, 70% were a result of non-working smoke detectors. And that is all we have time for on this reading of the journal. This is Chris Yerkes saying see you next week.